This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. As an adolescent boy, author Michael Parker found himself trapped with his family over Christmas vacation. Instead of hanging out with his latest girlfriend or listening to the top 40 radio station, he was stuck visiting his uncool cousins. Here's Michael Parker sharing his story, That Clapton Christmas.
That was a Christmas of Sherry Phillips, my first big-time crush, whom I'd bought a brown suede choker for Christmas. In return, she'd given me a 45 of King Floyd, singing Groove Me. And I know you're gonna groove me, baby. Make me feel good inside. That's what I was trying to talk to Sherry Phillips about. Sherry and I had to exchange gifts early because it was my family's turn to head over to St. Paul's that Christmas to spend the day with the McCormicks, cousins on our mother's side. We alternated traveling to our cousins and they to us on Thanksgiving and Christmas. They'd come over for Thanksgiving, so now it was our turn to drive the little over an hour depending on which route you took to St. Paul's. I liked my cousins, three boys close to me in age, and I didn't so much mind it once we arrived at their house. But I did not want to go that Christmas. For one thing, I'd planned on getting together later on with Sherry Phillips, and I was 14, and even though I had yet to read my Schopenhauer, I understood very well the notion that the world was nothing more than an extension of my will. Also, I hated traveling on Christmas Day. It was then, and is now, the most melancholy travel time of the year. Often, in December, in eastern North Carolina, the only thing vaguely white on the ground is the jaundiced yellow of fallow roadside fields. I've spent many a Christmas afternoon sweating in shirt sleeves. Our 68 Ford Country Squire station wagon, crammed with the seven of us, my parents in the front, my older brothers and sisters in the back, my youngest sister and I stretched out in the very back, was fresh airless and smelled of my oldest brother's hands, which inevitably, year-round, reeked of peanut butter. It being Christmas morning, there was nothing good on the radio, so we could not even distract ourselves with the obligatory fight over which AM station to tune into. WKIX, which favored top 40 of the Gary Puckett and the Union Gap or Motown variety, or WPTF, which broadcast a show my father liked called Ask Your Neighbor, an on-air yard sale featuring buyers and sellers from the entire coastal plain hawking mostly incomprehensible agricultural and industrial wares like manure spreaders and paint mixers. Nor was there much to look at outside. There were few cars on the road, the ones present slow-motion coasting. Country people, notorious for rising early, seemed abed still or already at church. The parking lots of Mount Moriah Baptist and Philadelphia AME Zion were filling up. Church, steeple, but where were all the people? From the backward glance of the very back, the world in reverse looked very twilight zone. I watched the occasional blur of a kid trying out a new toy, a lucky boy on a Honda 75 bumping over the furrows of a roadside field, or a girl in a driveway choppily pedaling a pink banana bike, her grandmama posted sentry on the steps of the ranch house, smoking away glumly at a cigarette I could tell from 50 miles an hour was extra long and extravagantly unashed. There were two routes from Clinton, my hometown, to St. Paul's. The front way followed the main highways, 24 to Fayetteville, then on to I-95 for the final dozen miles. The front way featured more distractions, a small grocery store hard after the bridge over the muddy Cape Fear River called the Hoggly Woggly, a play on the chain of Piggly Wigglies dominating Clinton and a joke I never seemed to tire of. The quick and dead hamlets of Autryville and Stedman, the sleazy outskirts of what we'd taken to calling Vietnam, a town back then given generously to providing vice to soldiers returning from the war. My father hated the interstate. He liked the back way. The problem was, it took longer, and the countryside seemed malevolent that Christmas morning. The fields straggled sullen and muddy alongside us. Wintry trees lined them, smudgy gray and sinister in the distance. The only landmark of distinction was a middle-of-nowhere house with a two-story porch made of lattice, painted yellow. For obvious reasons, this house appealed to the most wistful region of my imagination. I wanted inside it during a gold-plated sunset, wanted the diamond patterns to fall on the bare shoulders of Sherry Phillips. In a great big lattice porch, all you gotta do is groove me, baby. Make me feel good inside. The house of yellow lattice was not enough to quell the stultifying quarters of the very back. Halfway or earlier, my sister and I started to kick each other. Shouts from the back, admonitions from the front, the smell of hot metal, peanut butter, and red dust. I could not wait to get out of that car, even in St. Paul's. Which, being half the size of Clinton, a paltry 7,000 itself, was open season for blinkin' you'll miss it lone stoplight quips. When I think of the collective sarcasm of five reasonably intelligent, ironically inclined kids, when I compare it to the acid-edged repartee of my single daughter, in comparison so relatively benign, I don't understand why my parents did not stop at a bridge over a swamp in the back way and drown us all like a sack of unwanted puppies. But they kept us around, and we kept up our more cosmopolitan-than-thou insults. You'd think one dusty eastern North Carolina town would be about the same as the next, but even the presence of a Hardee's or a Dairy Queen is enough to justify pretensions. St. Paul's was so dead it appeared freeze-framed. I was shocked to see dogs roaming the sidewalks, leaves unleashed by a breeze, the blink of a time-temp bank sign. My cousins lived dead center of St. Paul's deadness, in a 20s bungalow that made our 50s ranch house seem straight out of the Jetsons. The ceilings were high, the plaster was bulging, the bedrooms opened into each other, dark and stuffy, like diseased internal organs. You had to pass through at least one to get to the bathroom, a situation which seemed to a 14-year-old like myself, the fourth of five children, in pursuit at all times of a little impossibly earned privacy, hellish. My cousins didn't seem to notice the unfortunate layout. They were always happy to see us. That Clapton Christmas, we treated them terribly. Out of the car, into the house, hey Uncle Bill, hugs to Aunt Dot, and we'd disappear into the front bedroom shared by Neil and Mark, wherein lay the treasure. Hundreds of comics our cousins had been collecting since they were old enough to earn an allowance. Superman, Batman, Green Hornet, Incredible Hulk, Spider-Man, who we liked because his real name was Peter Parker. We'd scoop them up and carry them abreast to the living room, where snug up under the blinking tree, we'd spread out and fall into our respective superheroed worlds. Our cousins would man the record player, spinning whatever was new. We shared their tastes. Blind Faith, Derek and the Dominoes, Fresh Cream, Band of Gypsies, Live at Leeds, Abraxas, Cheap Thrills. Sometimes Stuart, the youngest brother, would want to hear some Christmas music, but Clapton prevailed. Clapton was God. I'd read it on a wall near State College. He provided the soundtrack to the endless boxes of overblown elliptical dialogue and superhuman feat. I suppose I could lapse here into analytical mode and posit that our consumption of endless tales of superpowers on Christmas morning, accompanied by the hymns of our generation, was a form of worship. But if I thought at all during that anxious hour before we were called to card tables set up in the den, and during the harried feast of turkey, ham, rice and gravy, green beans greasy with side meat, broccoli and cheese casserole, fat buttery Jane Parker rolls from the A&P, jello salad and pound cake, if afterward, stuffed, back in the living room, reading away the quiet hours of early afternoon, serenaded by both sides of the history of Eric Clapton, my mind strayed from the comic at hand, it was to dream of Sherry Phillips. Everything I did on Christmas Day in 1972, I could as easily have done on a Tuesday in July, which is why this year was so different. I'd passed from that point where Christmas was highly anticipated, something to count down days toward, to where it was merely a day when I could not see my squeeze, and as consolation got to lie around and be rude to my cousins and read comic books and listen to Clapton until the sun began to set over the bare fields bordering the highly inferior hamlet of St. Paul's, and my father went from room to room snatching comic books from fierce clutches, and finally, in a last-ditch attempt to get us back in the car, picking up needles from records in mid-early 70s endless drum solo. Bye, cousins. See y'all next time. In the car, we'd miss the comic books, the obligatory fight over which radio station to tune into. My mother and father, preferring quiet on the ride home, would quell this spat, would make us miss also the albums our cousins had spun for our listening pleasure. My bleak mood was exacerbated by the dire combination of the back way as viewed from the very back. The light didn't so much die as leak away over the fields. I was stuffed still from lunch, but starving. My sister was all up into my space. To distract myself, I would think about Sherry Phillips, and that would work for a while, but I seemed to understand that Sherry Phillips would not last, that everything would change. Everything changed. My Uncle Bill built a large, sunny, modern house on his family farm a couple miles outside of town. Sherry Phillips got tired of my mess. When a few years later my cousins grew up and left home, my aunt threw out most of their comic book collection, which was worth a small fortune then and would by now be enough for early retirement. Clapton went solo, and instead of copying the dusty licks of black bluesmen, went to ripping off the talented but little-known genius J.J. Cale. Perhaps the most significant change was my attitude toward Christmas, which thereafter arrived with a looming melancholy, for my expectations of its magic, left over from our catechismed and Sears catalog childhoods, seemed impossible to meet. I no longer tried. My mind was not on family, surely the cornerstone of Christmas pasts, but on Sherry Phillips and the girls who followed her, none of whom, by the way, ever gave me a 45 by King Floyd, or they'd get their own essay. Christmas music began to work my nerves. In its place, I listened to the same albums I played the day before and the day after. The whole season thrummed with a low-level but decidedly adult anxiety about how I was supposed to feel. Losing Santa Claus was not such a big deal, but so soon after that, Sherry Phillips got tired of my mess, and then it wasn't very long until, morphing into his unappealingly soft rock alter ego Slow Hand, Clapton bolted too.
Michael Parker is a professor at UNC Greensboro. He read his story, That Clapton Christmas, which is included in the collection, A Dixie Christmas.